Thank you, Mr. Steele. For years I have sat comfortably where you are now sitting, assuming that none of our number are invited to address this gathering unless they are courageous enough or foolish enough to suggest some topic for discussion. That was a false assumption. The subject before us today is resurgent Islam and the response of the Church. And if it helps you to have some idea of our direction of travel, then here it is. In the first session, I want to say something about the development of Islam, looking at Islam's historical expansion, Islam's irrevocable mandate, and thirdly, Islam's current strategy in the Western world. Then, as Sandy has intimated, we sing a hymn, and you get your second wind. And in the second session, we will consider the Church's response to Islam by examining the historical responses the Church has made, the difficulties which we face in shaping our response, and finally some suggestions for positive engagement. Well then, in this first session, the development of resurgent Islam, and something briefly about the historical expansion of Islam. At a time when the Church was almost totally absorbed in theological controversy and power politics, Islam swept onto the stage of human history. And within a few years of Muhammad's death in 632 AD, the unified warring tribes of Arabia spread out in conquest. As Islam made its really very spectacular and remarkable advance, cities which once boasted a proud Christian heritage, like Damascus and Antioch, Jerusalem, Alexandria, and Caesarea, fell. Within a mere 100 years of its birth, Islam had conquered the Eastern Mediterranean, North Africa, Persia, and Spain. And once the hordes of Islam crossed the Pyrenees, it seemed as if all Europe would be gathered under its dominion. But the Battle of Tours in 732, surely one of the most decisive battles in history, stopped Islam's first bid for Europe. Islam was to wait a further 600 years before mounting its second great military offensive against Europe. This time the assault was launched in the east, where the Ottoman Turks were becoming a force to be reckoned with. Constantinople fell in 1453, and the Turks threatened to spread northwards into Germany. And really not until the defence of Vienna in 1529 was this second advance of Islam into Europe finally checked. In the providence of God, Europe for a second time was spared the yoke of Islam. And that was some 12 years, after Luther nailed his thesis to the door of All Saints Church in Wittenberg. Does this help us to understand the prolific references to the Turk in the writings of the Reformers? Not that the Reformers feared the content of Islam's teaching. Indeed, in 1542, Luther successfully appealed to the Council of Basel to allow the publication of a translation of the Quran. He wished Christians to know what an accursed, shameful, and desperate book it is. Of course, Luther is never noted for his mild language. While the Muslim advance was checked in Europe from the 8th century, it made significant progress in the East, advancing into Central Asia, through the Khyber Pass, through North India, and down to the Malaysian Peninsula, then across the Straits of Indonesia into the southern Philippines. The 19th and 20th centuries found Islam pushing down into the heart of Africa. Now, until quite recently, Islam's ability to influence the developed Western world has been fairly minimal. And there are two principal reasons for this. The first was colonial rule by Western powers over vast numbers of Muslim peoples. This resulted in the Muslim having little influence on local administration and even less at an international level. The second reason for the absence of Islam's voice in the Western world was a failure of Muslim nations to compete in the marketplace. There was a resistance to the idea of mass production, which would rob man of his God-given creativity. We are further told that Islam rejected the materialist values which it considered the Industrial Revolution was producing in the West. Since Muslim states remained unindustrialized, they were in no position to use economic muscle to influence other nations. These two major constraints upon Islam have been removed in this century. Colonial powers have been withdrawn, resulting in the emergence of Muslim nations. And secondly, Muslim nations have discovered that their oil reserves provided them with an economic base which enabled them to expand their influence. Influence which has been given greater momentum by a further twist of history. And I refer to the major demographic changes which have taken place in Europe since World War II. Large numbers of Muslims were encouraged to come to supply labour-hungry industries in the West. They came from the Indian subcontinent to the United Kingdom, from North Africa to France, and from Turkey to Germany. And it's been estimated that by the end of the century, 50% of the young people in France under the age of 20 will be Muslim, not through conversion, simply through these demographic changes that I've mentioned. Are we beginning then to see Islam's third major offensive on Europe and the Western world? In order to begin to answer that question, I want to move on to say something secondly about Islam's irrevocable mandate. Of course, it would be absurd to suggest that every Muslim has pinned to his bedroom wall a plan for the annexation of Europe. We all of us know Muslims who are genial, hospitable folk, far removed from the threatening, sword-wielding tribesmen who rode out of the Arabian desert. Is it then alarmist to talk of Islam's new European offensive? In order to answer that question, we need to recognize that Islam does have an unequivocal and irrevocable mandate for world dominion. Muslim scholars again and again state that the world is divided into two parts: Dar es Salaam and Darul Har. Dar es Salaam is the house of Islam, the actual realm of the Muslim faith, in which Islam has full political, religious control. Darul Har is the house of war, and refers to the areas of mankind still unsubdued by Islam. The aim of Islam is to subdue the whole world, bringing it under its political and religious control. Now, this affects the way in which Muslims are taught to view society. Let me quote Hussein Kuwalti, a respected Muslim scholar. The Muslim cannot remain neutral with regard to the state. He has an alternative. Either the ruler and the government are Muslim, in which case he supports them, or they are not Muslim, in which case he must reject them, oppose them, and do everything in his power to change them, peacefully or by force, by openly declared or secret activity. This is neither fanaticism nor prejudice. The question is much simpler. This religion was revealed thus, as a religion and as a state. It imposes itself upon individuals and groups, for it is the law of God, and it is impossible for us to substitute another. In other words, Islam's mandate makes no provision for peaceful coexistence with the non-Muslim world, only for world dominion. The mandate is clearly spelt out in the Quran, and again I quote, "Make war upon those who believe not, even if they are people of the book, that is, Christians or Jews, until they have willingly agreed to pay the jizya," that is, the poll tax, not Margaret Thatcher's poll tax, another one, "until they have agreed to pay the jizya or poll tax in the recognition of their submissive status." And again, "Believers, take neither Jews nor Christians as your friends, they are friends with one another. Whoever of you seeks their friendship shall become one of their number." Of course, for a whole variety of reasons, Muslims have not always pursued this mandate with vigour. The Muslim community in Britain is divided between conservatives, who would be happy to see it implemented, and the secular Muslim for whom life in the West means no more than an ability to add to his material status. However, this mandate, which has been hibernating in Muslim communities for so many years, is beginning to rouse itself. A new breath of life is being breathed into Islam, a resurgence which has been produced by a number of influences, and I would like to itemize them for you just now. First of all, a struggle for identity. Years of poverty and colonial rule have hitherto prevented Islam from having the kind of assertive place in the world which it considers it deserves. I suppose you might say that it was suffering from a massive inferiority complex. And Muslims are today encouraged to throw off their role as an underdog, and there is a new determination to gain recognition in the West, and of course oil reserves have made this a very real possibility. Secondly, the degeneration of Western morality. During the Iranian Revolution, the world became aware as never before of the antipathy of fundamentalist Muslims towards Western values. And of course, no distinction is made between Western values and Christian values. At the height of the revolution, young girls who wore Western dress had acid thrown on their faces, while those who wore lipstick had the offending cosmetic removed with sandpaper or a razor blade. The message was clear. The dangerous influences of a morally degenerate society would not be tolerated. These dangers have been identified as equality of the sexes, immodest feminine clothing with the low neckline and the high hemline, makeup, non-religious poetry, dancing, modern music, gambling, alcohol, etc. And there are some points, I'm sure, where we would be happy to sympathise and say, yes, some of these things have had an adverse effect on the morality of the nation. Muslims in Iran were told that these Western viruses were contaminating their society. This same revulsion of Western morality is evident among Muslims in our own land, and increasingly so. They express understandable concern about the morality of the nation, and they need little persuasion that only by the establishment of the mandate for Islamic rule in the land will the tide of moral degeneracy in the West be turned. Thirdly, reaction to Western learning. Muslims who have allowed themselves to be influenced by Western thought have been pressing for a liberalizing of educational methods. This would immediately initiate a theological crisis in Islam. Muslim students learn by rote. They are not encouraged to question their teachers or challenge their assumptions, or produce personal judgments. Western education, with its spirit of inquiry, cuts across the Quranic teaching, and I quote, "Do not pursue things you have no knowledge of." Ayatollah Khomeini gives expression to what is by far the greatest fear among conservative Muslims, a fear of Western learning, he said. And I quote, "We are not afraid of economic sanctions or military intervention. What we are afraid of is Western universities." In particular, the Muslim conservative scholar dare not unleash critical scholarship on the study of the Quran. Pardon me, but if you are a Muslim living in the West, how do you curtail a spirit of free inquiry? Well, an Islamic government would not permit such freedoms to undermine the Quran. Incidentally, it is precisely this challenge which lies at the bottom of Salman Rushdie's book, The Satanic Verses. Rushdie's title draws attention to the fact that within the Quran, references made to verses which were later expunged and replaced by others. In Muhammad's hometown of Mecca, there were 365 heathen deities, of whom Lat, Uzza, and Manat were chief. Among the many revelations Muhammad purportedly received from the angel Gabriel, One which was given gave permission for the worship of these principal deities, the three principal deities mentioned. But these verses were subsequently abrogated in favour of others advocating monotheism. This is a source of some embarrassment for the Muslim, and Rushdie uses his prolific imagination to suggest why the earlier revelation was first given and then withdrawn. Now, without condoning this book, which makes far from edifying reading if you can manage to get yourself into it, if you've tried, the storm which it created demonstrates the resistance of Islam to having the Quran's historical background challenged. Only a Muslim government, which controlled the educational system, could deal with it. Here they see to be one of the harmful effects of Western education. Fourthly, the success of military engagement 11 years ago, grassroots fundamentalist Muslims overthrew the military might of the Shah of Iran and his Western advisors. And this staggering victory has encouraged other fundamentalist groups around the world to believe that where there is a rejection of the virus of Western influence and a determination to establish the rule of Islam, then Allah will enable them to overcome even in the face of insurmountable odds. Parallels are drawn between the remarkable military victories which Muhammad himself secured against unbelievable odds and what has happened in Iran. The conclusion which is drawn argues that when Islam's mandate is taken seriously, then success is guaranteed. Final factor, the ineffectiveness of the church. This final factor, giving impetus to the call for a return to Islam's mandate, is identified as an ineffective church. Islam, as I said earlier, makes no distinction between Christian society and Western society. The church is seen neither to condemn the new morality nor to be effective in resisting it. Islam is persuaded that Christianity is a spent force in the West. Some time ago at a public open meeting, a Muslim speaker said, 2,000 years of Christianity has not created the perfect man. When we look at the world outside Islam, we see ignorance. Morality and religious life are decayed. Priests arrange dances to attract young people. Churches are for sale. Can you imagine a mosque being for sale? At which point the Muslims in the audience cried out, "Never! Never." The closure of church buildings, which in turn have often been taken over as mosques, is to the Muslim a clear indication that Christianity is dying. At present in the United Kingdom, there are over 300 major mosques and 1,500 places of prayer. What is perceived to be a dying church is seen by the Muslim to be the inevitable consequence of a people who have corrupted and turned their backs upon God's revelation. How does Islam respond? And again I quote, "The faith that stems from the 7th century believes itself to be continuous with all true religion, and to perfect what right worship everywhere intends. It gives final institutional form to the proper religious temper of mankind. It is the ultimate religion. The role of Islam in relation to all other faiths is to prune, correct, purge, and complete them." All of these factors are feeding resurgent Islam in the West. Even the secular Muslim who infrequently attends the mosque and seldom adheres to the five pillars of Islam feels their impact. Increasingly, the Muslim community is being convinced that the time is ripe to fulfill its mandate. But how is the influence of Islam to grow in the West and in the United Kingdom in particular? That brings me to my third point in this first address, Islam's current strategy for Western society. For Muslims are convinced that the green plant of Islam will grow out of the rubble of Western civilization, and the microclimate for its growth is being produced in a number of different ways. First of all, in the field of economics, The economic status of many Muslim countries has radically changed in the past 25 years. Indeed, the centre of gravity of the world's wealth no longer lies in control of the European and American banks, but under the signatures of oil-rich Muslims. Many Muslims believe that oil money is Allah's gift to them to promote Islam. The economic strategy and political ambition of Muslim thinkers was placarded during the World Festival of Islam in 1975, and I quote, "Unless we win London over to Islam, we will fail to win the whole of the Western world." London is seen as the key to Europe, and therefore so much money and effort is put into their mission program in this country. Rich Muslim states have for years been seeking to influence Britain to a more pro-Muslim stance in world affairs. They have carefully invested oil revenue, bought into large sections of London's real estate and British businesses, and they hold a substantial stake in British banks. Contracts worth millions of pounds are being placed with British businesses. Our labour market would become increasingly fragile if these contracts did not persist. Western governments, as recent days have made clear, Western governments live under the fear of another oil crisis and plummeting exchange rates. And it is naive to think that this kind of investment does not begin to influence government decisions at a whole variety of levels. Secondly, in the field of politics, we see something of Islam's strategy. Islam's political consciousness is growing in Britain. The changing demographic patterns are increasingly favouring Muslims, whose population in the United Kingdom now measures between 1.5 and 2 million. Indeed, there are some who would say as much as 3 million. There are more Muslims resident in the United Kingdom than Christians attending church regularly on a Sunday. Muslim families are numerically greater than those of their non-Muslim neighbours. And so by the end of this century, they will represent a sizeable part of the electorate. And with what consequence? In many immigrant areas where Muslims are in the majority, all three major political parties now favour Muslim candidates. Sitting MPs in large Muslim constituencies are under constant pressure to accommodate and appease their Muslim constituents. Recently, representation has been made to effect changes in the law. And that brings me on to my third subheading. During the Salman Rushdie affair, sitting MPs with Muslim majorities were prepared to advocate change in the blasphemy law. Now, if the current blasphemy law was changed to accommodate and embrace Islam, then technically, each of us could, I presume, be charged by Muslims with blasphemy on every occasion we declared Jesus Christ to be the Son of God. Many conservative Muslims are pressing for a separate legal code allowing for Muslim laws for marriage and divorce, banking, ritual slaughter of animals, prayer observance, and the call to prayer. But the more radical groups of Muslims want the British or Roman law to be replaced completely with the Sharia or Islamic law. For Islam teaches that civil law must always submit to the precepts of the Quran. Fourthly, education. In the field of education, the influence of Islam is equally apparent. One thinks of the early pressure to change the religious curriculum in primary and secondary education. More recently, there has been a call for government-funded Islamic schools because the Muslim believes that Quranic instruction must be the overriding factor in education. The Al-Kar Inquiry, which was published in 1986, gave weight to this goal. One of the contributors, Karim Al-Rawi, described his boyhood experience. I came to Britain as a child having just passed 13. At school I was subjected to the unrelenting attempts of well-scrubbed, porky-faced religious instruction teachers to convert me to the tenets of Protestantism and other fallacies. Fixing me with their beady eyes, they would deliver the absurdities of the Trinity with all the conviction they could muster. Of course, the rest of the class could not give two chews of a toffee apple as to whether God was three in one or one in three. Again, such a welter of illogicality and reason long abandoned, the beauty of the Quran bespoke its truth in a manner that struck me as irrefutable. Islam's suspicion of Western values of morality and fear of educational methods which encourage critical inquiry has given even greater impetus to these demands. Islam's patronage is making considerable impact upon some of our universities. In a recent round of government cuts, many universities were severely hit financially and began to look around for sponsors. Some have found the oil states eager to meet bills, provided the university agrees to put approved Islamic textbooks into the library and establish a chair of Islamic or Middle Eastern studies. Fifthly, Islamic propaganda. Since the World Festival of Islam, there has been a substantial growth in the field of Islamic propaganda, as Islam has sought to rehabilitate itself and appear as an attractive alternative in the decaying Christian West. Today, their polemical literature comes in a glossy cover. It is well presented, professionally written, and persuasively and cogently argued. Quotations from the Bible and the Church Fathers are included. The Islamic Propagation Center in Birmingham has produced a number of pamphlets designed to debunk and undermine the Christian faith. And the material they use could well have been lifted directly from the works of higher critical scholars. Let me give you just one example. You will be familiar with the fact that all four gospel writers record Jesus' entry to Jerusalem on a donkey and yet fail to mention his ascension. Let me quote then the comment in one of these leaflets. Could God Almighty have been the author of this incongruous situation, going out of his way to see that all of the gospel writers did not miss their footing, recording his son's, inverted commas, his son's donkey ride into the holy city, and yet inspiring them to black out the news of his son's heavenly flight on the wings of angels. This attempt to encourage Christians to question the authority of Scripture is not limited to written pamphlets. One of Islam's foremost apologists, Ahmed Didat, is constantly active in challenging Christians to face him in verbal combat and public debate. And his practice is to confront Christians with a whole list of supposed biblical discrepancies. A Christian reporting in one of these debates said, the best the Christians in the audience could do in response to this aggressive Muslim challenge was to wave their Bibles idly in the air. Finally, the jihad. All of the Muslim strategies mentioned thus far might be subsumed under the heading, if I can borrow Mr. Still's phrase, of quiet infiltration. But there is one final option which calls for some comment. The jihad. The revolution in Iran and the more recent polemic of Saddam Hussein is a sobering reminder that integral to Islam is the notion of jihad or holy war. While a great many Muslims in the West would want to distance themselves from this notion, fundamentalists consequently point to the place given it in the Quran. In a book entitled The Quranic Concept of War, Major General S.K. Malik says, "The Quran provides a strategy of war that penetrates deep down to destroy the opponent's faith and render his physical and mental faculties totally ineffective. Towards this end, it prescribes its own rules and principles of war to shower its unlimited strength and blessings on us. The one and only condition that it imposes upon us is its total acceptance and application on our part." In answer to the question, has not Islam on the whole given up the concept of holy war, Sheikh Abdullah Ghosha, speaking at the annual meeting of the Islamic Research Academy, says, "It is unlawful to give up jihad and adopt peace and weakness, unless the purpose for giving up is for preparation." The success of the jihad in Iran has encouraged other Muslim groups to take the jihad seriously. The unarmed Iranian population, covered with their white shrouds, were seen to put to flight the Shah's forces, who were heavily equipped with the latest Western weapons. Khomeini, commenting on this point, says, "Holy war means the conquest of all non-Muslim countries. Such a war may well be declared after the formation of an Islamic government worthy of the name, at the direction of the Imam or under his orders. It will then be the duty of every able-bodied adult male to volunteer for this form of conquest, the final aim of which is to put the Quranic law in power from one end of the earth to the other." At present, the jihad doesn't have much popular support among those committed to seeing Europe bow down under the yoke of Islam. But it would be wrong in any assessment of the strategies currently open to Islam to neglect its existence. If all I have accomplished in this first session has been to awaken us in some measure to the seriousness of the threat which Islam poses to the West, then that will be sufficient.